You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome this afternoon to Bookworm. Today my guest is Robert Plunkett, the author most recently of Love Junkie, published by HarperCollins. He's the author as well of My Search for Warren Harding. You know, this book, which is about a woman of middle years who falls in love with a hero of gay pornographic movies, seems to be about the kind of person who is addicted to being unrequited. She goes through an affection for a gay sometime arts administrator before she falls in love with her pornographic hero. And so it would seem that her fondness is for dissatisfaction. What would you think?
I would certainly agree with you. I think that that's one of the things that I had in mind when I was writing the book, because I kept seeing it happen to so many of my friends. They always ended up falling in love with someone who was not going to love them back, and they were only happy in a situation like that.
I wondered, since this book takes place in the kind of sort of the end of the club years and the Fire Island years in the gay scene, are these characters any more likely to fall in love with one another than one is to fall in love with your heroine, Mimi?
What do you mean fall in love with one another?
Well, it seems like she is coming into a community where it's not just that she's a straight woman falling in love with a probably gay man, but that most of the gay men in this book don't have much patience for love of any kind.
No, well, I think that's one of the things that I've noticed about gay men, particularly as they get older. They don't fall in love with their peers. For some reason, they fall in love with their adolescent ideal, and they keep, looking for the guy they had the crush on in high school, and they get very fixated, and they kind of end up, a lot of them, leading rather empty emotional lives because of this.
Is that part of the subject of the comedy in this book? Because, it did seem to me to be a kind of love comedy, but with not very much of an idea about what love would be, intentionally or otherwise.
Well, yes. I mean, but the question is, what is love?
Exactly.
And, to my mind, the two great, great love stories in literature of the past, let's say, 50 years, are Lolita and Portnoy's Complaint. And Lolita is, of course, the most hopeless love situation you could possibly imagine. He's in love with a 13-year-old who couldn't care less about him. And in Portnoy's Complaint, who is he in love with? I mean, he's in love with some kind of fantasy woman who he then meets and turns out to be a monster. So now what was the question?
That part of the comedy of the book seemed to be the comedy of a love story, not in a novel in which true love was otherwise possible, that this improbable love was as probable, in fact, as any, given the world of this novel.
To me, the greatest love stories are always the most improbable, and I consciously did try to make it as improbable yet believable.
Now, when we first met, we talked about unreliable and unpleasant narrators, and you seem, at least on the basis of these two books, Love Junkie and My Search for Warren Harding, to have a penchant for that kind of narration that I seem to recall first in its level of somewhat benighted obnoxiousness in the good soldier, you know, a kind of fatuous and horrible person praising himself to the sky.
Uh-huh.
What's your attraction to it?
I do not know my attraction to it, but it was there from the beginning. As a child, I was drawn to books like that. My favorite book, one of my favorite books in the entire world, is Little Me. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that?
Patrick Dennis's book.
Mm-hmm. You know, which has a first-person narrator who is in effect a monster, and the entire story takes place between the lines. And that somebody could actually write a book like that and make it work, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I was just amazed that you could actually do that. And I'm astonished that it isn't done more often in literature, because people believe the narrator. They, mm-hmm. you know, they believe the narrator. And I naively thought that they didn't believe the narrator. You know, in my first book, the guy's so obviously a jerk that I was very taken aback and kind of offended when some of the reviews complained that, you know, this guy's a jerk. Why bother reading this book?
Well, what we were talking about when we met last week was that you had said that perhaps your strategies with that narrator had succeeded a little too well, in that I had mentioned to you that what seemed somewhat distressing to me about the book was its level of misogyny, and that the narrator was clearly, at the very least, a repressed homosexual, but that the book didn't let on if that was in fact the case. And you said, well, in fact, that was the case, and that no one reading the book had mentioned this.
Right. And I, we're talking about the Warren Harding.
Yes.
To me, the Warren Harding book is narrated by a man who is quite obviously a repressed homosexual. There's no getting around that. When you analyze the book from a literary point of view, all the plot points, etc., happen because of his repressed homosexuality. His relationships with women are the classic relationships that a homosexual man has with women. There's the aging star, there's the fat woman, there's the middle-aged housewife who likes to redecorate. So to me it was quite obvious. Nobody's ever mentioned this, which kind of struck me as odd. And one of the frightening things about it was that heterosexual men are the biggest fans of the book. And the reason they like it so much is because the narrator's so hostile toward women. They get off on that. They love reading about some guy saying how awful women are. And I learned an enormous lesson from this, and I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it has something to do with the hostility that heterosexual men feel for women.
This new book, Love Junkie, I do think that one of the great unconscious subjects of comedy, and I'm surprised that it hasn't been done before, is the anxious, very nervous-making comedy of attraction that occurs when a straight man falls for a gay woman, or a gay man falls for a straight woman, or a straight woman falls for a gay man. There seems to be, you know, an enormous threshold for misunderstanding, and even to some extent for tragedy. It seems that all, for instance, of both Paul and Jane Bowles's novels are about people who don't know what sex they themselves are or their friends, but are willing to spend the duration of entire novels acting as if they knew.
Uh-huh.
How did the... It seems at the same time a very difficult subject, at least especially now, because of political correctness. It seems as if there's going to be, you know, an absence of tenderness for, in this case, a woman who becomes enamored, as they say, of an ass.
Uh-huh. Well, it's funny you should mention the word tenderness. I don't think there's any tenderness in the book. I couldn't imagine me writing anything tender. And I guess that says more about me and what the world has done to me than anything else. But I kind of really don't. I don't see that happening very often. I see people being mean to each other is really what I see.
And so you don't think the tenderness plays a role in comedy?
Not in comedy. No, I don't think tenderness plays a role in comedy whatsoever. No. I mean, can you think of a comic tender moment?
In your book? Or
in any book.
In any comedy? Well, as we go on to the next question, I'll try and think of one. It does seem to me that actually that pathos has a role in comedy. I mean, it may be a comedy that you may not like, but it's the essence of Charlie Chaplin. And sometimes, for all of his stoicism, the essence of Buster Keaton as well.
Yeah, but pathos and tenderness are not the same thing I don't know, maybe I'm wrong because I don't know literary terms that well, but to me pathos is deals with one person, but tenderness really requires interaction between two people, a kind of reciprocation. Pathos I love. I'm nuts about pathos. And I'm very good at it.
I'm talking to Robert Plunkett, the author of Love Junkie, published recently by HarperCollins. But in any case, writing this book took 7 years. Can you tell me about why it took so long?
I'm a very slow worker, number one. I have a full-time job, so I only when I come home from work, I have dinner and then I work. The big problem was I was writing from the point of view of a woman. And that was very, very difficult to do. It's very rarely done successfully for a man to write as a woman or for a woman to write as a man. And the problem is that you have to figure out how are men and women different emotionally, because the reactions have to ring true. And even in that Alison Laurie book called Foreign Affairs, do you know that one? Which she writes from part of it's from the point of view of a man. And I love the book, but to me the point of view of the man really didn't ring true. There was something about the way the man conducted the love affair that it wasn't convincing. And I wanted to make it convincing, so it took kind of like endless figuring out of what a woman would really do in this emotional situation.
Who are your comic masters, the people who, I don't mean who are brilliant necessarily as writers, but who always succeed in making you laugh, which seems to me to be a different thing entirely?
Well, I was going to argue with your second point, but let me tell you who my comic masters are. First and foremost is Betty McDonald, author of The Egg and I, who... I feel she kind of invented the voice that I use, which is a first-person, very self-deprecating kind of voice. She also wrote a wonderful, wonderful series of children's books about Freddy the Pig. Are you familiar with those?
Did she write Freddy the Pig?
Yes, she wrote Freddy the Pig.
No, I think she wrote Mrs. Pigglewiggle.
No, I think she wrote Freddy the Pig.
we'll have to arm wrestle about this.
Okay, well, she was certainly one of the best. Let's see there. But back in the 40s and 50s, very late 40s and 50s when I was growing up, there was a whole bunch of women writers who would write like this. That Delafield woman who writes The Provincial Lady, are you familiar with her book? She writes like that too. And I grew up on this kind of writing. I don't know why, but you know, to me it's the way to write. It's just a wonderful.
Well, one of my favorite sections of the library. People don't go there now, and perhaps it doesn't exist. We were also talking about this last week. Was That section just after the plays was the humorous autobiographical experience section. And there was Betty McDonald and Cornelia Otis Skinner, right. But also the people who wrote Cheaper by the Dozen, mm-hmm. and the people who wrote Anything Can Happen, the book by Helen and George Papashvili. Sometimes this was stories about how one's parents came to America. Sometimes these were stories about traveling in Europe, and inevitably there was a de rigueur chapter about how one ended up spending a night in a whorehouse without realizing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the essence of Love Junkie, in a way. It's the woman who experience has not prepared for her present situation, and so everything is a surprise to her. And at the same time, you know, these are the 80s, and so the situations are ever so much more specialized and sexualized than she's been prepared for. Did you find in the course of this, because this book gets somewhat, at least by implication, raunchy, that there were things that you were having fun with that you had to take out of the book?
There was a lot of stuff cut out of the book. There was a lot of sex cut out of the book, and a lot of sex was toned down. I'll be glad to show you those parts. I still have them. But I realized that to make the book work better, I had to pull back a little and make it not quite so raunchy. There's a scene missing in the book, which is in a sense the whole climax, which is where Mimi is not to give anything away, but she's through chain of circumstances is forced to fill in at the last moment when one of the porno stars does not show up. They need a last-minute replacement, and they use her. And I must say that that scene was beyond me, which is the reason it's not there. Even I couldn't write that one.
You tried, you knew that you couldn't?
I tried, and there was just no way I could get through that one.
Now, one of the things in both of these books that makes me laugh the most, I think that you are inimitable on the subject of modernist art movements, whether they're experimental feminist theater productions in Warren Harding or a whole gamut. This woman, Mimi, finds herself exposed to gay life in Manhattan in the course of her work for a grant-writing organization for experimental underground artists. This is too real and too funny to be believed. Was that your own experience?
Yes. I was in the art business. I worked for the New York State Council on the Arts, and I was one of the grants officers and helped decide who got the money. And during the course of that experience, I learned many, many things and saw a tremendous amount of very, very bad art because I had to go around New York State and decide whether the people should get the money or not. And I came away very disillusioned. Is this show supported by the NEA?
No.
Oh, okay. Because I do kind of feel that the government should stay away from the arts.
You do?
Yeah. Uh-huh. For 7 years, that was my job. And I saw how it inevitably becomes political and how it becomes various special interest groups fighting over money. Mm-hmm. That's what it ends up being.
Well, it was interesting to me because this is something that I have observed, at least in my life in Southern California. In Love Junkie, avant-garde art and avant-garde sex seem to go almost hand in hand,
that's other. Very interesting because one of the things that I was doing in the book was I had to find the point where the most middle-class, unhip woman in the world would become involved in the sexual underground. And it is the art world, you know. That's sort of where everything like that meets. It's the one place everything meets.
Other than the opera, Is there, you know, still an upper crust world of the arts, as in A Night at the Opera, the Marx Brothers, or is it now all that weird? I get the feeling that if a person wanted to become involved with the arts because of the sense of culture and privilege they conferred, that they would be hard put to find anything but, you know, a lot of bizarre underground stuff to sponsor. Am I wrong? But
well, in Manhattan, certainly that still does exist. You know, the trustees at the Metropolitan Museum are certainly very, very much still of that world, and I assume the Metropolitan Opera. And I don't know if rich people really, they're afraid of the avant-garde. Or at least that's been my experience, unless they're kind of hip to begin with.
Because I was talking to Bill Hoffman about this. He's a librettist and did the libretto for the recent Figaro opera at the Metropolitan. His plaint was that if you were not working in the avant-garde, you barely worked in the arts today. And I think that that is true as well in the book world, too, that unless you're taking on something heavy, a book that's comic, like Love Junkie, may have a hard time finding and winning its audience. People are all looking for very deep dish stuff.
Yeah, they are, and I've never really kind of understood that. I consider my writing very avant-garde. I'm the only person in the world who does.
Well, tell me about that. I'm curious. In what way?
It's experimental. You know, it does a lot of stuff that you're not supposed to do. Yet it borrows its techniques from things that are generally considered cheap, shallow, and trivial, like let's say Irma Bombeck or something like that. I mean, you know, there's a lot of Irma Bombeck in Mimi.
Mm-hmm.
And there are there's an awful lot of sex.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess one of my favorite forms of comedy is the comedy of outraged propriety. You know, take someone who shouldn't be in a given circumstance and put them there, and I'm always ready to be amused, and that is the essence of this book. I'm just wondering what you mean by experimental.
Experimental in it doesn't fall into any category, and people automatically consider anything funny to be very lightweight. And, you know, don't ask me why. To me, it's just the stupidest, silliest thing in the world, because comedy comes from anger and bitterness and outrage. And I feel that's where Love Junkie is coming from. And yet it's considered light summer reading. And on one hand, that's absolutely terrific. But on the other hand, I'm figuring out why what I think I did is so different from what everybody else thinks I did.
it seemed to me that by the end of the book, in which the AIDS epidemic is centrally featured, that AIDS comes in some way as much as a surprise to the world of this book as the sexuality of the world she finds herself in comes to Mimi Smithers. That in the way, this book makes a certain proportion possible that gay culture is to middle class culture as AIDS is to gay culture.
Well, I kind of follow what you mean, but not quite.
Well, At one point, a book like this, I think, would be written in a different way and would come to a different epilogue. The final chapter here takes place at a funeral. It's not examined very closely, but Mimi finds that her experience among gay men has made it a possibility that she can mourn the passing of a gay man friend as if it were a social occasion. And so AIDS once again becomes the occasion here for a comedy of social propriety, of, as elsewhere in the book they say, well, we learn how to cope.
Okay. I certainly can see you reading that into it. To me, where the last chapter was coming from was that, to a certain degree, I see the book as an extended essay about the total lack of understanding between homosexuals and heterosexuals. And by the end of the book, Mimi, representing the heterosexual world, still doesn't get it. It's still going over her head, and the fact that all these people are dying, she still interprets it as a social occasion as much as anything. And her head is even more firmly in the sand than it was before. Because, you know, we saw AIDS happen, and AIDS was not mentioned in the heterosexual world for years and years and years. Homosexuals were considered expendable. It was a frightening thing to watch, and it horrified me. And to me, that's where that last chapter is coming from.
Interesting. So, in other words, this book is really about a much less benign form of incomprehension than it might at first seem.
I feel so. In many respects, I hesitate to say this because it's one of the things I've learned is that the book's about whatever the reader thinks the book is about. But the thing I struggled with it while writing it, and one of the reasons it took 7 years, was that AIDS was happening, and what did this mean in the world? And it was also very interesting that I had no idea how the book was going to end, and had written 10 different endings, and they were none of them were right, until I was tested for AIDS myself, and I was tested, and I tested negative. And a week later, the book was finished.
I've been talking to Robert Plunkett, the author of Sex Junkie, recently published by HarperCollins. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.